Coming up on this episode.
Now, if this is not a myth, then archaeologists using modern day underwater deep sea equipment should be able to find some debris from the military disaster that took place here. But one must keep in mind that this event took place 3,400 years ago. That's a long time. And since most scholars who follow the traditional view that the crossing would have been closer to modern day Cairo over in Goshen and stuff like this, they have found nothing of this. And I believe that they're looking in the incorrect place. Hi, welcome to Evidence for Faith. It's your host, Michael Lane, and we are proceeding now in our third lesson on the series that we call the Exodus. Several people, laymen, scholars, experts, et cetera, and anybody, they doubt that the Bible is true. They view these people as mythical figures. They view these people as the events as fairy tales. Yet there is so much evidence to support the Bible, so much. That these people are real, that these people did live, that these events did take place, as recorded in the Word of God. Believers, agnostics, anybody, atheists, they're all pretty much familiar with the story called the crossing of the Red Sea. And that's where we're at in this lesson. Now, in the two previous lessons, we covered what I believe is probably the best identity, I think, for the Pharaoh of the Exodus, his identity of who he was. And we saw evidence concerning also during that series about the patriarch Jacob's archaeological evidence supporting that. We also looked at evidence that these plagues that happened in Egypt actually did take place. The Ippur papyrus and stuff. We've looked at this stuff. And we also looked at the beginning of the Israelites' exodus out of Egypt and to the Promised Land as recorded in the book of Exodus. We finished, though, with a cliffhanger, the crossing of the Red Sea. Now, here we go. What body of water was it? Where did this occur? Well, we get several clues given to us by Moses as he wrote this under the inspiration of God, one of which is in Exodus 13, verse 18. Exodus chapter 13, verse 18 reads, "But God led the people around by the way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea." Now, this verse confuses many people and has confused people over the centuries because the way it reads in the Hebrew. Remember, we're translating from Hebrew into English here. In Hebrew, the noun for Red Sea is the word Yam Suf. Now, Yam is easily defined as the word sea. I mean, that's just what it means. It means sea. It's used throughout the Old Testament for the word sea. For instance, in Jonah chapter 1, verses 4 and 5, when Jonah goes down to Joppa, which is at the sea, and he takes a boat across the sea, that's the word that is used there, Yam, as referring to the Mediterranean. There's no question about what Yam is. It's what sea is it? What's the Suf? That's the thing. That's the key, the Suf. This word can, if you look it up in Hebrew dictionaries and stuff, or lexicons, it can mean reeds, it can mean rushes, plant-like things, or it can mean the color red. So which one is it? Now, there are different lakes around there. There's one called the Sea of Reeds. Many people have talked about that's where the crossing took place. Well, now, since we've seen what the word Suf means, that it has different type of meanings like that, let's go to the New American Standard Bible. The New American Standard is a word-for-word translation. It's a formal translation. It's considered by many scholars to be one of the more accurate translations we have. This word in the New American Standard Bible, twice it is used, Suf is used for the word reed, it's translated as reed. One time it is translated for rushes, and one time it is translated for weeds. But 24 times, wow, that's a lot, 24 times Suf is translated directly as red. So I checked with 32 other translations that I have to see how they translate that verse, to see what sea it is. And most often it is identified with the term red. But of those 32 translations, there were two that did not translate it that way. And that was the Aramaic Bible and also the International Standard Bible. They both translated it as read. So what I did next is I went to the Septuagint. I took out my Septuagint to see what does it say in the Septuagint. Now remember, the Septuagint is the Old Testament in Greek. It was done during the intertestamental time by about 70 different highly trained and intelligent Jewish scholars to translate from Hebrew into Greek. So checking with the Septuagint, it came out to be the word for red. Also, I checked the 1917 Jewish Publication Society of the Tanakh and to see how they translated it, and they too translated it as the word red. So you have the Greek scholars back in the 250 BC or so translating this not as read the word for rushes or something like that. They translated it as red back around 320 BC. The Jewish scholars did this. Then I even checked an old Geneva 1587 Bible. It too has the word red. So many translations have it down as red, is what we're getting to the point here. So even so, many scholars have written hundreds of papers detailing where they believe that the crossing took place. Now over in there are a series of lakes. Some of them are no longer there. The Suez Canal has been dug through with that area. But there used to be many, many lakes there. We know this from ancient writings. There's no question about it. And so many of them say it was one of those lakes where the crossing took place. One of those lakes, by the way, was called the Bitter Lakes, whatever. But anyway, and others will call it the Suez Canal. They take this verse meaning those things. Either it was one of the lakes over there or the Suez Canal. Let's take a look first of all. Let's examine what they say about the Bitter Lakes, those little lakes that were in between the Gulf of Suez and the Mediterranean Sea. And one of those, by the way, was called the Reed Sea, as that fits. So that sort of seems like that could fit. Now, these lakes were all very close to each other, going from the Gulf of Suez to the Mediterranean, but they weren't connected. But later on, they would be. Before the time of Moses, pharaohs came and they dug an actual canal connecting these lakes from the Gulf of Suez all the way to the Nile River, which then fed into the Mediterranean Sea. Thus, there was a canal in ancient times that did that. They believe this was probably done around 1850 BC. Like I say, that's long before, 400 years or so before the time of Moses. And also, this canal was very, very shallow. We can tell from what historians wrote about this. According to a paper written in 1975 by Sneh, Weisbrod, and Pareth, this man-made waterway only had to be about 2 meters in depth for the type of crafts that they had, floating crafts and boats and things on that waterway at that time. So it didn't have to be deep. They also agreed with what the ancient Greek historian Herodotus wrote in his book, The Histories, concerning this, because he too writes that the pharaohs built a canal, making a canal going from the Gulf of Suez to the Mediterranean. Herodotus also tells us that Pharaoh Necho rebuilt it, deepened it and stuff a little bit, but rebuilt it around, that would have been around 610 BC. We know also from Herodotus that Darius I, the Persian, he rebuilt that canal. So it was a very important canal for commerce and trade. It was super important. That's why it was made. Now there's a problem with this Pharaoh's canal that was made in ancient times. The problem is it does not fit the topography of the rest of the Exodus story. And what we see with the Exodus story, it doesn't fit. It's too flat, is what I'm saying. And we're going to see. I believe that this is a key point, disqualifying these places for that because it is so flat in that area. It's not mountainous at all that you see here. It has many serious flaws. Those through the Bitter Lakes, through the Canal of the Pharaohs, or even the Suez Canal, I'm going to show you that I think there's serious problems with those ideas. The most important one for the pharaohs, the Canal of the Pharaohs, is it's so shallow. Thus, how would a huge horse-drawn army of chariots be drowned in such a shallow body of water that's just maybe 2 to 3 meters deep. Not everybody would be drowned by that. No. Many scholars believe the Exodus was then at the Suez Canal. For instance, Michael Obleth, he agrees that the crossing must have been in the Suez Canal. And he writes about this in his book, The Exodus Itinerary Sites. And in this book, he describes why he thinks it's the Suez. But I believe he and others miss the major clue that makes the Suez Canal an unlikely spot. For one reason, the Suez Canal has been dredged many times, and there has never been recorded anything about a debris field of chariot parts and stuff like this, evidence of destroyed army, Egyptian army. It's never been found. Thus, I don't think this is the correct place. Others suggest that the crossing was somewhere down further in the Gulf of Suez. And if you follow in our map, looking down the side of the Gulf here, this too runs into a very serious problem. Because we are given an idea of how many people are in the Exodus, how many people there were. We get this from Exodus chapter 12, verses 37 and 38. And it reads, "And the people of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children. A mixed multitude also went up with them, and very much livestock, both flocks and herds." Now, as one who has been in camp ministry for many, many years, to over 20 years I worked in camp ministry, and I'll tell you, a group that size with all of that stuff, all those animals and stuff, you're going to need a huge campsite. I mean, a gigantic campsite. This could be easily over 1 million people, easily, possibly 2 or even more. That's a lot of people with cattle and herds and stuff like this. And here lies the problem with the western side of the Gulf of Suez. There's not an accommodating campsite that can box in the group. Remember, the Israelites get boxed in as they're crossing. They have the sea is on one side, the Egyptians are behind them, and to the left and to the right, the passage is unattainable. They cannot go either way. They are trapped. That's what's going on. And no place on the Suez Canal just seems to fit the geography that we see here. It just doesn't make it a large campsite that they could be there where they couldn't escape. But going back to the term Yam Suf, Yam is noted, we don't have a problem with that, it's the sea. We got that down, it's the sea, Yam is sea. But can we discover where other Bible writers use the term Yam Suf? We can. We can check with other books of the Bible and other places in the Bible where the term Yam Suf is used and determine what it means. Let's take a look at some of these. In Exodus chapter 23, verse 31, it reads out of the English Standard, word-for-word translation, "And I will set your border from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines and from the wilderness of the Euphrates, and I will give the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you." Now, from this description, God is giving us a description of the promised land. Now, this is the land that God promised Abraham. This is going to be what is allotted to Israel. And from here, most scholars, a majority of them, believe that the sea that is being mentioned in Exodus 23:31 has to be the Gulf of Aqaba. If you take a map and you draw from the Gulf of Aqaba, the tip of it, modern-day Eilat, Israel, and you go along the border of the wilderness, all the way to the Mediterranean Sea, then you go up and you draw all the way to the Euphrates and come back down, that pretty well fits the land of Israel that you see in atlases of the old nation of Israel. Here's another one. In 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 26, we read, "King Solomon built a fleet of ships at Ezion Geber, which is near Eloth, on the shore of the Red Sea in the land of Edom." So here again, we see Yam Suf. Now, this passage clearly means the modern-day port city and resort city of Eilat, Israel. Where is this? It's sitting on the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba of the Red Sea. Nobody really disputes that whatsoever because it fits in with the other things that we know that Solomon had a fleet of ship, and it all fits with biblical things. Another one, the book of Numbers, chapter 21, verse 14. It reads, from Mount Hor, they set out by way of the Red Sea, Yam Suf, to go around the land of Edom. Now that's a key thing, Edom. This passage also describes this Gulf of Aqaba because it mentions the country of Edom. Edom is mentioned. And Edom is on the south side of Judah. That tribe or Israel on the south side is where it was. Many people go to Petra on vacations and stuff over to the Middle East. Petra, which is in modern day Jordan, that area goes all the way down. Jordan and Israel have lines. They sort of connect right down towards the bottom there. And that is the place that's being mentioned here. So Edom, the nation of Edom, if you look in atlases and stuff, you're going to see it goes down to the Gulf of Aqaba. So that's what the description is. Here's another clue. In the book of Deuteronomy, chapters 1 and 2, in those two chapters, there's mention of a place that is called Mount Seir. Now, my friend Dr. Stephen Notley, in his atlas, The Sacred Bridge, Mount Seir, he says, is not one single mountain, which it's not. It's a whole mountain range going from the south end, as he describes, of the Dead Sea down to the Gulf of Aqaba. That is a long mountain ridge. If you have a topographical map, you can see this. This appears to support, again, the Gulf of Aqaba as the Red Sea, that Yam Suf is that Red Sea. Yam Suf also appears in the book of Judges. In the book of Judges, we love that book. It's a lot of fun. A lot of all these judges and tales and stuff. Well, in Judges chapter 11, verse 16 through 17, we read, but when they came up from Egypt, Israel went through the wilderness to the Red Sea and came to Kadesh. Israel then sent messengers to the king of Edom. That's a key thing. We're talking about Edom again. Now, this passage, too, speaks of the Israelites traveling through the wilderness to the Red Sea. If it's traveling through the wilderness, how much wilderness is there from where Goshen was to those Bitter Lakes? Or how much wilderness is there down to the Gulf of Suez or the Suez Canal? It really seems to fit, in my opinion, more to the Gulf of Aqaba. And since it mentions the nation of Edom, and Edom sits right above that, it's the southern border of Edom, this seems to fit very well. One more, and likely the most significant verse, giving direction and placement of crossing a deep body of water during the Exodus, comes from the book of Jeremiah, who was writing on the prophecy to befall the kingdom of Edom. Remember, Edom is just north of the Gulf of Aqaba. Jeremiah chapter 49, verse 21 reads, at the sound of their fall, the earth shall tremble, and the sound of their cry shall be heard at the Red Sea, Yam Suf, Red Sea. There can be no doubt whatsoever that Jeremiah is giving a prophecy concerning the destruction of the nation of Edom. And Edom's southern part is where you find the Gulf of Aqaba. Another key clue to this whole mystery of the crossing of the Red Sea is from a sentence that's found in the book of Numbers, which is detailing all of these events as a review. They've already happened. And Moses writes in Numbers chapter 33, verse 7, and they set out from Ethem and turned back to Pi-Hahiroth. Did you notice something about this verse? Now, this is so cool because there's two things I want to point out to you. The first one seems insignificant. It's the words turn back. This describes now the Israelites are traveling. Remember, they're traveling through the wilderness. And a point comes up where God says, hey, turn. And most translations have it written as turn back. Some translations, though, have it as just turned. Quite a few others place it right in there, turned again, instead of turned back. So whenever you see, and I love to do this, and I advise all people to do this, when you get into difficulties where you see, and this is why reading more than one translation is so important in English, But when you come across something that's difficult with the words, go back to the original language. So what is the word that the English Standard Version used as turn back? It's the word shub, shub in Hebrew, which, now you can just get a Hebrew dictionary or whatever and you start to get some ideas to it. Shub means literally to just turn. It can be turn all the way around. It can mean turn to the left. It could turn to the right. It could mean just slightly go off this course. What it's meaning is just you're changing your direction. It doesn't necessarily mean a 180 degree turn all the way around. That's not what it is. And that's why some translations say they just turned. That doesn't give us much information that way, but that's what it is. Thus, the word could easily mean to just turn to a different direction. Now, the King James Version, for instance, and the NET Bible, New English Translation, and like I say, other translations simply just say the Israelites changed direction that they were following. Now, this is important, and it indicates that the Israelites changed directions when they're in the wilderness, which I believe was the Sinai Peninsula. So that's one point about that. Another key, and probably the most mysterious of all, is the location of a city or something that is mentioned there, a place, we'll just say, a place called Etham. Now, no one knows where Etham is. Oh, there's been many opinions given on where Etham is. But there's never been an archaeological dig that has produced authoritative conclusion from artifacts of Etham. Scholars, as I read different papers on this and read different books, scholars can't even agree if it's a village, if it's a fort, if it was a temple, as some suggest, or just an insignificant place. We don't know where it was. Now, scholars that hold to the traditional Exodus route, that the crossing of the Red Sea was up at the canal, the Bitter Lakes, or at the Suez area over on the west side of the Sinai Peninsula, they hold this, and they say that they place that Etham, and if you look on many atlases, that Etham will be over there. I checked so many different atlases, and I found Etham being all over the place. It was very interesting. It just seems to be a place where they sort of fit it with their theories, more or less. So scholars that hold to the traditional view will show it over or actually in. Many of them will actually place Etham in what is today modern Egypt, in very close to the city of Cairo. John Schreier, in his article in Biblical Research, believes it is what the Arabs called Jebel Hatan, which is in the Sinai Peninsula. Others place it at the southern tip of the Sinai Peninsula. In his book, The Lost Sea of the Exodus, Dr. Glenn A. Fritz, using the same clues that I have come up with, the same things that I've been pointing out to you, he mentions that he believes it's near the Wadi Girafi, which is in the Sinai. Now, if Dr. Fritz is correct, it fits very well with the Gulf of Aqaba being the crossing point of the Red Sea. But no one knows for sure. We can't be certain of this because we haven't found all the archaeological evidence yet. And when you're looking through all these areas, trying to find one spot, that's quite a chore. And like I say, scholars don't know. Some places in Egypt, some closer to the Gulf of Aqaba. We don't know where it is. I've even seen one atlas or one paper describing that Etham was over in what is the Negev area of Israel. And I doubt that because it doesn't fit with the rest of the stories. So no one knows, but following what the clues I have found and reading Dr. Fritz, it seems like he seems to be along the same line of logic as what I have, taking the different passages and putting them all together. Now, another clue where the crossing took place comes from the book of Exodus chapter 14 itself, when we read that the Israelites were camped at Pi Hahiroth. That is a major clue. What is Pi Hahiroth? Well, I believe, and I'll describe why, I believe it's the present-day Nuweibe Beach. And there's a lot of reasons for this. Nuweibe Beach is on the eastern side of the Sinai Peninsula. It is a huge beach. It's one of the few beaches you can see from outer space. It is so large. But it's not so much the size, it's what the word Pi Hahiroth means. And so when I came to that, looked it up in my Hebrew lexicon just to check, and I looked with other sources and stuff, and many scholars believe, even in the Strong's exhaustive concordance, it says Pi Hahiroth means mouth of the gorge. Now, some will take the words Pi Hahiroth and try and place it over in Egypt. But as we said, those lake crossings, the canal and stuff, there's no mountains there. And so they change the meaning of the word from what it says in these dictionaries. They're changing it to fit their story. I'm taking the word as what it says in the Strong's exhaustive concordance and my Hebrew lexicon, where it says it's the mouth of the gorge as the meaning. That fits very well. Oh my gosh, this is like a perfect fit of a shoe and a foot going together, because this really shows evidence when you put this together. It fits so well that Nuweve Beach on the western side of the Gulf of Aqaba is the place. The entrance to this beach, now this is how it fits so well. The entrance to the beach at Nuweve goes through a wadi and deposits onto this beach right between two very large mountains. Matter of fact, the whole area is extremely mountainous. And with all these mountains around there, remember, the Israelites had to get boxed in. And coming in, it's really the only way in to this large beach. And this beach is huge. It is a monstrous-sized beach. But if this is correct, if it's Nuweve Beach, the Egyptian army would have to come the same way as the Israelis did. There's only one way in, and if God blocks them there, they would not be able to pass. So this fits perfectly the biblical description. And God tells Moses, stretch out your hand towards the sea, and I will divide it. And then, as this happens, they're going to be able to walk right over to the land of Midian, which is in Arabia. So we read this, Exodus 14:21, one of the most exciting verses in the Bible. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove back the sea by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. See, this is so different from the Hollywood version. The people see the sea being separated, and the thing is, they don't go into it right away because a strong wind blows all through the night. A desert wind blows through here because they've got to walk through this. And so God uses this wind to blow over the passage so that they will have a walkway through the sea, allowing the sand to dry. Now, once dry, you can walk on it and go right across. Look at the next verse here, Exodus 14:22. And the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall to them on the right hand and on their left. Now, one can only imagine what this must have looked like. I mean, Hollywood's tried to paint illustrations of this and show them in motion pictures and stuff, and they've made some nice tries, but remember, this place is really deep. So Aqaba is really, really deep. But the thing is, it is a slight incline going down to the bottom and coming back up. A slight incline. And apparently, it took a whole day for like these 1 to 2, maybe possibly 3 million Israelites with their herds and stuff and carts and everything to be able to cross through this path. This is obviously not going to be a small little path of, you know, just like a sidewalk, because you're moving a lot of people through very quickly. And so they go through. Apparently it took a whole day for the Israelites to cross because God didn't destroy the army until it reads the next day. Thus, after the Israelites had already passed through, God allowed the Egyptians even to follow them. In Exodus 14:23, the Egyptians pursued them and went in after them into the midst of the sea, all of Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. So there's an army that goes in there. After the Israelites were across and morning came, the Egyptian army pursued them. But they had a problem with their chariots in doing this while crossing. Again, Exodus 14, looking at verses 24 and 25, we read, and in the morning watch, The Lord in the pillar of fire and of cloud looked down on the Egyptian forces and threw the Egyptian forces into panic, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians." So it was just before dawn. Then Pharaoh's army goes into the Gulf, and God releases the water, where it came down from the top or came from the bottom, we don't know. But the water came in and engulfed them. And the army that was there with all the men and the horses. Now remember, the horses, that's key. Because remember, for time frame, horses had been killed in the plague in Egypt. So Pharaoh had to get horses from outposts to come in to fill 600 chariots, taking time. And then they go in there, and the horses and the men, they all perish. And I don't think this is in like a couple of, like 2 meters of water. Plus, how big? 600 chariots with all these? That's a big group right there also. It continues in verses 27 and 28. So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal course. When the morning appeared, as the Egyptians fled into it, the Lord threw the Egyptians into the midst of the sea. The waters returned, covered the chariots and the horsemen, and all the hosts of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea, not one remained. This is the story of the destruction of the Egyptian army, a key point to the whole Exodus. Not that just the Israelites went across, but the army of Egypt. Now they're really going to be short on horses. Now the army has been totally destroyed. And I believe it was off or between Nineveh and Saudi Arabia. As we learned in the last session, Josephus, the famous Jewish historian, in his book, Jewish Antiquities, he writes about this also. For instance, now, when the Egyptians had overtaken the Hebrews, they drove them into a narrow place. They also seized on passages by which they imagined the Hebrews might fly, shutting them up between incredible precipices and over the sea. Stop here for a second. It's talking about mountains there again. For there was on each side a ridge of mountains that terminated at the sea, which were impassable by reason of the roughness and obstructed their flight. Wherefore, they were pressed upon the Hebrews and their army, where the ridges of the mountains were closed with the sea. This sounds so much like Nineveh with the mouth of the gorge right there, and it fits. The description fits perfectly with what we see. Being that the Egyptian army was destroyed here, and the access to the spoils of the defeat are so deep in depth, it's going to be impossible for the people at that time period to be able to go down and recover chariots and weapons. But we should see a debris field from this disaster. To find debris, though, you need to look closer at the site of the Egyptian defeat. Now, let's just examine for a moment the Gulf of Aqaba, the precise area. As we stated, Nineveh consists of a huge beach, and the upper eastern part of the Red Sea, called the Gulf of Aqaba, is between it and Saudi Arabia. Now, this span of water, standing at Nineveh Beach, looking across to Saudi Arabia, it's only a little over 10 miles, about 17 kilometers. You can easily see the other side. But what is really peculiar about this spot is that it has no fringing reef there, just a lot of sand and sparse, large coral growth, but very sparse. Really interesting, because the Red Sea is a famous, very well-known dive destination for scuba divers, tourists and stuff to see coral. Off the shore there, there's not a whole lot of big coral reefs. It's just sparse heads of coral. Because corals don't build on just sand alone. Now, coral are little polyps, little animals that bond to each other, but they have to grow on something hard, like a boulder, a sunken ship, boats, things like that, a dead reef. They can grow back on top of it. Also, when you examine this area here at Nineveh Beach going down and going back up, it goes down between a 5 and a 7 degree incline. Most people can actually walk that without much difficulty whatsoever. And this is very important to the story, because if you examine the Red Sea in other places, particularly in the Gulf of Suez, you're not going to find a nice incline going down and then going back up. You don't see this. It would have, if it was in the Gulf of Suez, they'd be rappelling down ropes to get to the bottom, walk across, and then have to mountain climb back up to get to the other side. That's a little difficult for geriatrics and children, plus the animals. So this is very important to this whole story, because if you examine this, it really seems to fit. This incline is forgiving. There's no major drop-off, and the people would be able to do it this way. I believe, too, this shows that God foreknew this event was going to happen. And he set up, in the book of Genesis, after the flood, he set up this system where this is where the Exodus will take place. Because God was not caught off guard. And it wasn't like by luck the Israelites happened to be in a place where they could go through and cross by on the other side. No, God had it all planned. All planned. Do you see how interesting this is? And it sort of parallels some of the things in our life. We sometimes go through difficulties not knowing what's going on, but God has a plan. We might not see it. The Israelites couldn't see it. It was underwater. But then when God opened it, they were able to walk across. So if you're going through a difficulty right now and you can't see any solution out, well, God still knows and he has a plan. You just have to be patient and trust him in faith. Now, if this is not a myth, then archaeologists using modern-day underwater deep-sea equipment should be able to find some debris from the military disaster that took place here. But one must keep in mind that this event took place 3,400 years ago. That's a long time. And since most scholars who follow the traditional view that the crossing would have been closer to modern-day Cairo over in Goshen and stuff like this, they have found nothing of this. And I believe that they're looking in the incorrect place. I'll tell you a story. Back when I was in middle school, in Sunday school class one time, we had a substitute teacher who came to talk to us. And what was the topic? This teacher came, he was from a Bible institute, and he came and he was speaking to my Sunday school class on the Exodus. And he's telling us about the Exodus. Now, this Bible scholar from Chicago was teaching us the traditional view of the Exodus, that it took place over very close to modern day Cairo, and also that it was these lakes that they crossed, that it was a sea of reeds that separated, that the wind blew and pushed the water against the reeds, and they were able to go through and through these bitter lakes. And he even told us how deep these lakes were, just a couple of meters at the most, and it goes across, et cetera, et cetera. And so after the class was over, after his lecture was over, as we're sitting there, he asked if there was any questions. There were a few. I politely raised my hand, and he responded by asking me my question. And I said, I just want to know one thing. How do you drown an army of over 600 chariots and men and horses in like 4 feet of water? Because you said that this lake would have been approximately 4 feet of water. How can you drown that many people in there? And why would that be such a massive miracle? He paused, looked at me at the eye with a very stern, very frustrated look, in fact, I still can recall. And then he just simply dismissed the class. That was it. The whole thing was over with that one. Anyway, I believe he had the wrong place. Now, what evidence is there to back up the points that I've made in this lesson? Well, there have been a few. There have been a few discoveries, a few studies that have been done, showing scholars who have examined the Gulf of Aqaba in search of this debris field of the Egyptian army. One is presented in a DVD that's called The Exodus Revealed. Another is in a two DVD set, which was on Netflix, and a lot of people have seen it advertised, called The Red Sea Miracle, parts one and two. There have been many papers that have been written, and even some books that have been written on this idea and this hypothesis that I have by using these clues right out of the Bible. Matter of fact, I even one time was watching one of the early morning TV shows, and there was a person on there who had just come from the Middle East, and he was describing this also. And we see that there are people who follow this train. Some scientists and even a few archaeologists are departing from the traditional view. And I mean, Remember, tradition is not always right. If tradition is, well, if more people believe this, that's got to be true. That's a terrible way to believe something just because a lot of people do it. If that was the case, today we'd only be believing that there was only 1,026 stars, because that's what was believed and written about since about the time around Christ for the next couple of hundred years. Everybody believed that. That didn't make it true. You got to look at the clues from the Bible and how they're matching up, and discoveries that are made, and how do they fit with the biblical patterns and stuff. And there have been some archaeological discoveries and people who have explored this theory. One of which was Dr. Leonard Mollard, who actually went out and used a deep sea device to be able to see down at the bottom. But he didn't have the best equipment for this. And there's been others who, divers and stuff, who have said they've explored a little bit around there. And they say that they found some remains and stuff. But remember, most of this is going to be very, very deep, beyond the levels of what is safe scuba diving. Now, one must consider that this event happened to 3,400 years ago in a tropical sea. Now, in the tropical sea, there's a lot of different life, a lot of different type of worms and other things that would actually eat wood. And after being down there for 34 centuries, that's going to make a big difference here. The marine life, I mean, the coral could possibly start to grow on stuff, but wood, you're not going to find much wood because the wood would be eaten and consumed by different organisms and broken down. But corals could begin growing. If there's something that is really large, it could start, even if it was made of wood, they can begin start to grow on certain things. That's why we see sunken ships and stuff with some coral growth on them. But coral grows really slow. That's another major thing. Most marine life, like corals, they do attach to an obstacle, an object, a substrate, and then they reproduce either by budding or by sexual reproduction, preserving the shape of what they're growing on by doing this. Now, I've taught marine biology for over 40 years. I've led trips, marine biology trips, for almost 40 years. I've even written a book on marine biology. And I can assure you that there are animals that eat and consume wood in the ocean. I can also assure you that corals can grow in certain objects. If you put something down there that's a weird object, it'll start to grow in the shape of that object. You do see this. And large reef-building corals don't grow on sandy surface. It just won't grow there on alone. They have to have rocks or debris. So down there, what we would find is possibly in certain areas where coral can still grow, because it doesn't grow super deep, it needs sunlight, we could see possibly the shape of chariots and possibly maybe weapons, a few weapons. Now, let's consider a segment of this exploration from the DVD, The Exodus Revealed, and see what these scientists discovered, Dr. Leonard Mollard in particular, as he studied some of the area at the bottom of the Gulf of Aqaba.
For more than 20 years, divers and explorers from three continents, each intrigued by clues linking the Gulf of Aqaba and the biblical Yam Suf, have come to Nuweiba Beach seeking possible evidence of an Israelite crossing. Their search focused on the 600 chariots the Bible says were destroyed in the Red Sea. Inscriptions thousands of years old, and the few chariots recovered from ancient tombs, reveal much about the construction of these legendary vehicles of war. Could any of them actually be found on the seafloor off the Nuweiba Peninsula? Based on his analysis of documentary evidence, Leonard Mollard had long suspected the Aqaba coast as the probable location of the Red Sea crossing.
Here we can see the divers. Now, these are scuba divers, and I want you to notice the color that you can see on the outfit of this diver. The yellow is there, so that tells us they're not very deep. Even his spare regulator hanging down is yellow. So it gives you an idea that they're not super deep at this point. What we're going to be looking for are pieces of coral, chunks of large, large coral. Now, coral, as we've said, grows on things. It has to have an object. So there's something here, a boulder or a rock or whatever. You can see there's different species of coral growing on this formation here. And that's the thing, how this this area at Niue is so different than any other place in the Red Sea, because they're sparse coral. It's not a solid wall, like a solid reef. It's sparse. There's large areas of sand and just small pieces of coral. So people could walk through here. And remember, this is 3,400 years ago. So coral grows really slow. So it's growing on different objects here, as we see on this sandy bottom.
So for instance, if it would grow on a wooden artifact, the wood would normally disappear in the seawaters after a time. But if you have corals growing on the wooden artifact, the coral could have the shape of the wooden artifact. And then the corals would consume the wooden material over periods of time, but still keep the shape of the wooden artifacts.
During the course of his explorations, Moeller observed that the pattern of coral growth at Nueva differed from other parts of the Gulf. Unlike the coral at the northern and southern ends of Aqaba, which often forms large, dense reefs, some covering many acres, the formations at Nueva Beach are generally smaller and scattered randomly across the seafloor.
Now here is a large size reef, and there are some of these in this area. But notice there's many, many different varieties of coral. Here you can see a massive reef, and this would not be possible for the people to walk across. But notice how different this is. It's mostly just sand. And 3,400 years ago, there wouldn't be even much of this coral here. Here again, we can see we're rather shallow. This is not far off the shore, but you can see there's green algae growing along the bottom here. Green algae at this color has to be sort of close to the surface. So we're not too far from the shoreline of Niue at this point here.
When we dive and when we film at the Nueva location, we look for certain structures, and you try to look for 90 degree angles or circular objects, wheel-like structures. So that is what you scan for, so to speak, when you dive.
Now notice how this type of coral is growing. This is very, very uncharacteristic of reef formation of hard corals. And this is not one species of coral. There's different species here, but you can see how they're growing on a pillar coming up. Now there are things called pillar coral, but pillar coral is not like this. This appears to be something that was already there, a spike or a shaft going down, and then a round, because that's a round circumference at the top that different species of coral are growing over. And this is a classic piece that just shows this is not something that is natural. This is actually growing on a man-made object. Also, you'll notice at the depth here, the yellow on his arm has disappeared, and even his fins are slightly a different color. So we're much, much deeper in the water, because red disappears first, then yellow, then orange. You just go through the different colors of white light. And they, as you go deeper in the water, they disappear. They get filtered out. And so at this point, this diver is much, much deeper.
Since the earliest explorations at Nueva, one distinctive type of formation has often been identified on the seafloor. A slender, table-like structure, sometimes standing on end, with a coral-encrusted base, a straight shaft, and a circular top.
It's a 90-degree angle, a right angle, between something that looks like an axle and the wheel. And you can see this in different varieties, and it looks very different from normal coral growth. And it is like a man-made structure with a coral growth on it.
Here you can see a variety of different species. There's one type of coral right at the top center. There's a different type way over on the left, more of a leaf type of coral, and more of a finger type on the opposite side. So it's not one type of coral. There's different species, different types of coral animals living here. But they're growing obviously on something. And it's been there for quite a while to get this type of a reef formation growing on it. It would be so cool to be able to go deeper and actually see these things. What is at the bottom here? This is a part of hard coral. It's growing, remember, not on sand. There has to be an object there. But if you notice, it has a circular thing to it. Now, many corals, there are some species of coral that will grow in a circle, but this one is almost too perfect. Also, it has a hub in the center. There's got to be something underneath that, but it is illegal by both the Egyptian, and this is more on the Saudi side. You just can't touch this. It's illegal, and you can't collect it. You can't hardly do anything to the thing whatsoever outside of just observe it and photograph it. This that's being you're looking at right now is roughly the circumference of a chariot wheel that has been discovered in one of the tombs that you can see here. Here's the chariot, a close-up of the wheel, and using that, now just picture that in your mind growing sideways on the bottom, and you can see this really resembles the remains of an Egyptian chariot. Now, wasn't that interesting? Photographs taken from that expedition have shown extensive coral growth down in the shallows, I mean, still in deep water, but still in certain shallow areas of coral heads growing reminiscent to Egyptian chariots. You see wheel and axles seem to be covered in coral. And if that is what that is, it would make perfect sense because coral would grow that way. Coral boulders grow where there's sunlight. Now, as you keep going down in depth, coral won't be able to grow down there in the deeper waters. But around the shallows, they can. But there's another problem about diving there, not just because of the limits of scuba diving. The Egyptian government and the Saudi government do not allow just people to go in and explore. As a matter of fact, if you go to Nueve Beach, which is a resort area, there's many hotels and dive things that are there. The dive guides are only allowed to go to certain areas, and that's it. You can't go off on your own. They take you to certain areas, specific little areas where they'll take you and let you see. But that is one of the reasons that we're not seeing a whole lot of studies done here. It is so hard to get permission from the government. And that's the reason there's so little evidence today to support that there's a debris field there. But some minor studies have been conducted, but none that I know of have actually ever, nobody's ever done a full survey of the area, because we're talking 50 square miles of an area here from Nueve Beach to Saudi Arabia. That's 50 square miles of exploration. That's going to be very expensive trying to cover that. You're just going to have a very difficult time with that. Now, I do want to caution you about something. I hate to bring this up, but it is something that's very important. If you just go into the internet, onto the internet and type in like the Exodus route, you might see a whole lot of videos showing pictures of gold chariot wheels that are intact and even certain pieces of a chariot that look perfectly intact, and you'll even see some like skeletal coral growth of looks like a human or a horse skeleton. You have to be careful what you're looking at, because much of this is done in association with a man named Ron Wyatt. Now, be cautious of anything that you come across with the name Ron Wyatt having to do with the field of archaeology. He claimed to have found quite a few amazing things in his career. Now, he's not a trained archaeologist. I believe he was worked in the medical field. But the thing is, he claims, and have written books and appeared on television and everything frequently, about finding numerous chariots, coral-encased horses, skeletons of horses and human skeletons, and he claims to have found weapons and everything coral-encrusted. But this man also made other claims, such as he claimed that he found Noah's Ark. He claimed that he found Noah's anchors. He's claimed that he found the temple treasures from the Solomon's temple. He claims that he found the Ark of the Covenant buried on Golgotha. And through a cave that he went through, he saw this, and he saw that it was right under where Jesus was crucified, he says, and the blood of Jesus bled down the cross through cracks in the ground and landed on the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant. And then he also claims that he had the blood that was there analyzed, and he said it only had half the number of human chromosomes. I mean, he made a ton of claims. And many of these are fictitious. I'm sorry. He had a good motive. He wanted people to believe in the Bible, but he was not totally giving the truth in everything, because some of the things he claimed have been verified, very few, or he has also talked about things that have been discovered by others, and they are verified. But some of these others are really, really bizarre, yet they flood the internet with this. And these are frauds. Like I say, he had good motive. He wanted people to believe in Christ and in the Word of God. But God is a God of truth. Telling lies and being fraudful is not the way to do it. That's against what God wants us to do. So, like I say, be cautious. He did speak sometimes on verified archaeological sites, and he talks about them, as other archaeologists have done. But most scholars, I'll just tell you, most scholars in the field of archaeology, if you mention the name Ron Wyatt, they just instantly turn you off. That's it. They won't believe anything else you're going to talk about if you use that name. So be very cautious. And there's a lot of discoveries that he claims to have made, but very few are true. Most are fictitious. I'm sorry, but that's the way it is. Now, back to our story. After celebrating their victory, which is recorded in Exodus 15, and the Israelites then left Baal Zephon, which is described in Exodus 14 too. That's where they're at now. That was their camping site on the east side of the Gulf of Aqaba, land of Saudi Arabia. Then it says they began to move together as a group, following again the cloud and the fire across. And Moses gives us a couple of clues where they're going. The first one comes from Exodus chapter 15, verses 22 and 23. And it reads, "Then Moses made Israel set out from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. Therefore, it was named Marah." No one is sure today where this was. There's very few geographical clues to this. Just talks about places where there's water. And there are areas where there are streams and stuff around the area where they would have come out of the Red Sea. But this place was contaminated, and they complained to God about it. They start complaining that you can't drink the water here. It's bad. So God actually does a miracle for them, and he also warns them to make sure you listen to my commands and go where I tell you to, and they set out again. So we don't really know where this Marah was, but that's, you know, there's quite a few places around with streams that would possibly fit it. Anyway, moving on, the next thing we see is in Exodus 15:27. It says, "Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they camped there by the water." So they're going to be spending some time here. According to Scripture, we have an oasis, is what's being described. It's called Elim. Now, there is a place like that on the Arabian side that fits this description. It fits it. Botanically and topographically, geographically, this all seems to fit into one spot, being the place where the biblical Israelites, where they stayed. And today, there's watering holes that are still there today, flowing with water for passerbys and animals. There's an abundance of water. And it says that they camped there for a period of time, according to Exodus 15. Afterwards, they were led out to the mountain where Moses met with God at the beginning at the burning bush. And this is in Exodus 16, verse 1. We read, "Then they set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt." So here Moses is giving us more clues, and he's giving us a time frame to see how much time has expired. Using the Hebrew calendar, this comes out to be approximately just slightly more than 6 weeks, this whole journey taking place. Again, this makes the Hollywood version really wrong. It seems like this happens just in a few days, the whole thing. But no, it was like 45, 47 days. In chapter 16, we also read that the people again began griping to God This time about food. We can't find food. There's no food here. There's no McDonald's to pull in or whatever. So they start complaining to God. So God provides another miracle in the form of manna, which we have no idea what it is. But they start eating this, and this is what they're going to eat until they come to the promised land 40 years later. But it says that the people walked on through the wilderness of Sin and came to a place called Rephidim. It appears to be a very flat place where they will camp. As we'll see in the next lesson, they're near the foot of the mountain where God appeared to Moses earlier at the site of the burning bush, Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb. We read this in Exodus 17, verse 1. All the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages, according to the command of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Where they found themselves now is another desolate place. It's not like the oasis at Elim where they came from. So what do the people do? They complain to God again. And God's going to answer them, but we'll leave that for the next lesson. I hope you've enjoyed this. I hope you got some things out of this. And always study your Bible carefully. And until we meet again, take care and may God bless.
Support the show. Become a donor at evidenceforfaith.org/give.